WGCU News, this is the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. This is Where the Serpent Lives is the latest work of Daniel Mwinedine. His debut short story collection, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. He grew up with one foot in the U.S. and one foot in Pakistan and had a career as a corporate attorney in New York before he turned to writing full time. This is Where the Serpent Lives explores feudal Pakistani society in the country and the city. Mwinedine's writing is very beautiful and evocative, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with him today. Daniel, welcome to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So this is your first novel.
That's true. Yes, it is. Yeah, I've only got two books. I'm a late bloomer. So I had the book of short stories and now this one, which I guess we've decided to call a novel.
Okay. We're going to get to that. Well, I'm a big fan of late bloomers because I am one myself. So I appreciate that. But it's so beautifully written, too. That's another reason I kind of couldn't believe it was your first one. Okay. The book begins with Bayazid, a young boy who was orphaned and taken in by the tea stall owner. And I read that you based that character on someone you knew. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. When I was a little boy, I was about 8 or 9, I lived in Lahore with my father and mother. And we had this sort of group of drivers who lived in this little room near the garages. And one day shows up this man who is on whom I based this, and who he was older than us. I was 8 or 9. He must have been in his 20s, but he was cool and big and beautiful and was an excellent carom board player. Everybody was playing carom board in those days, which is this sort of game with where you sort of hit these strikers into a corner. And this guy initially was just sort of on temporarily, and then my father became very fond of him and persuaded him to join us full time as our driver. He became my father's driver. And then really all through my life until the present, he and I have been both great friends, and also he's been sort of my buddy on a lot of adventures. I'm very fond of trekking and hiking and go up in the mountains in Pakistan, and he would be the driver on those expeditions, and is an excellent driver. And so that's who it is. He still works for me. He's now quite old, but he's emeritus, I think would be the same thing to say, but he's still certainly somebody I rely upon a great deal.
And has he read the book? Does he know he's...
No, he hasn't, but he doesn't read in English.
Yeah.
But I told him about it, and he said, look, do whatever you like, I don't mind. And his son is now actually running my farm. So they're all, I think, quite amused by the idea that, especially the son is very amused that his father has become this sort of figure in my book.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, so that gets me to another question. The young character, Saqib, wants to be a driver. What is it about that position that is so special and enviable? You covered it a little bit just now, but can you say more about that?
Yeah. Well, the thing about driving is, first of all, you're piloting this multi-million dollar vehicle machine. And that is by itself a status, you know, position. But also you're the guy who's sitting there with the owner or master, whatever you want to call him, employer, whenever he leaves the house. So the driver inevitably becomes close to the owner, and close in a different way than any other member of the household, because you're sitting there, you know, in Pakistan where the flights don't really work. The flights are constantly being delayed and canceled. So people tend to drive around great distances more than you might in America, say. So, you know, for example, in my case, my farm is good solid 8 hours from Lahore, where, you know, I'm based. And, you know, we make that trip all the time. 8 hours for us is nothing, but it's obviously it requires that the driver and I sort of take turns driving it. So in the course of that, the driver and the master become close, become intimate, they share intimacies. And then, of course, later on, that means that when, you know, he has the master's ear. It's a position of power. I remember reading somewhere that the Marcos, Marcos, the Philippine dictator, his driver had become his become an important member of his administration. And I remember laughing and thinking, yep, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it has to be someone who's trustworthy and who can hear all your conversations. And yeah, that's very interesting.
Exactly.
I love this character, Bayezid. I'm going to keep asking you about him. So he comes to befriend boys from a private school, which there's very much of a class chasm between him and them. Do you think it's easier for adolescents or children to cross the class barrier?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, kids aren't aware of that in the same way, you know, aren't aware of the distinctions. And those are things that you learn as you get older. So absolutely. And, you know, kids are just more flexible in what they are willing to tolerate and what they're willing to embrace. So absolutely. There's no question. When I was, you know, a kid growing up in Lahore, I played with anybody and everybody who showed up. And that is certainly the case in my story where, you know, there is a, you know, Bayezid finds that, you know, these boys, he has to be careful with them because if he seems to be, you know, pushing himself forward too much, they'll push back. But the way he does it, you know, sort of subtly and quietly and bit by bit, then he creeps into their confidence.
He's a really wonderful character because he sort of comes from nowhere and anywhere. He's very curious. He's ambitious. He even teaches himself to read. Did you think of him as sort of a tour guide for the reader through those class differences and through the city?
No, not really. I mean, the book grew organically, starting with that first story. And I didn't realize exactly what a large part he would play until I started writing the succeeding stories. But I agree with you. I think that's partly what the role he plays, that his is the strongest through line. I mean, he, you know, at the end, he's the critical member. So yeah, he's clearly the magic carpet on which the reader will ride through the book.
Yes. And I mean, if you can't tell by my question so far, I was so interested in the class differences that you were writing about. And it seemed to me that in Pakistan, language is like a class tip-off. Can you describe that, sort of how when you hear someone talk, you can sort of tell what class they're from? Is that right? And can you say more about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's one big distinction, which is the distinction between Urdu and Punjabi, because in Punjab, where I'm from, people of the upper class or upper and middle classes generally tend to speak Urdu, and people in the villages speak Punjabi. And yet, interestingly, the people, particularly people from the villages, they won't really embrace you and take you to their heart unless you speak Punjabi. And people in the city, and especially people, you know, wealthier people, generally don't speak very good Punjabi. So I've found through my life that because I speak Punjabi, it's my native language, since I live on a, you know, I've spent so much time in South Punjab on my farm, that speaking, as soon as even though I look very American, for example, and Pakistanis always assume that I'm an American, and yet I can speak two sentences of Punjabi and they will immediately drop their guard and you know, acknowledge me as being, you know, fully Pakistani as much as they are. And the other thing about Urdu is that there are many sort of polite ways of referring to somebody. You know, you can, so that there's the, you know, in for example French, you have the, you know, the tu and the vous, and we have many more gradations of that. So you could, but the way in which you address somebody is very important. Whether or not you use their name is important. The language is very much full of all these markers of your relative position as you speak to somebody.
That's so interesting. And since you've spent a lot of time in the U.S., can you compare it to the U.S.? Did you find those markers in American English too? Could you peg
class? Not really.
Yeah.
In America, you can tell a lot about somebody by their accent and their vocabulary, but not. It's much less a class society, you know. I mean, there's no comparing Pakistan and America in terms of how stratified they are. America's, well, less and less as time goes on, but is generally a fairly, you know, egalitarian place.
Yes, or so we.
Or so we like.
Or so we hope, yeah.
Or so we wish.
Wish, exactly. Your character Rustum says, I quote, "I don't know a single family in Lahore that hasn't been completely screwed by fighting about property," unquote. Can you say more about that? I feel like that's also at the center of some of this writing, is the property and squabbling over property or disagreeing over property. And I wonder if you can just say more about that.
Absolutely. That's not something that's restricted to Pakistan. I found this exact same thing about in America, for example, that, you know, Aunt Bessie dies and 20 years later, the two heirs just can't get over the fact that Aunt Bessie gave her silver mirror to one of them and not to the other. And it's the same thing in Pakistan, except, wealthy families in the West, exactly as wealthy families in Pakistan, fight hammer and tongs about the property, you know, because especially if you've been born with property, you don't imagine that you're going to earn more. What you imagine is trying to get hold of what there is there. And that's certainly true of the Pakistani upper class, that in the Pakistani upper class, often or generally, the money has been made generations before. And everybody's trying to hold on to it desperately because they damn well don't want to make more or don't know how to make more.
Mm.
So that's, I think, very universal, that in families that have property, it's very common for them to fight when at the time of inheritance.
Yes, and feel they're entitled.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Daniel Mouinedine about his new novel, This Is Where the Serpent Lives. Daniel, it struck me that, let me say, I was reading this book when I was visiting my husband's family in Egypt, and it was almost a similar, there were house staff milling about, the children and grandchildren are all sort of, everybody's sort of in sticks around the main homestead, which I think is different from American families. I feel like the kids move out and go somewhere else as soon as they go away to school or something. Is that similar to the Lahore of your childhood? Were you growing up in that kind of atmosphere with lots of people milling around?
Yeah. In my case, my family had all been living together and just piled upon each other. And when my mother is American, and when she came to Pakistan, she immediately realized that she couldn't live in that way, that she needed to have something more resembling a Western household. So my father and mother actually sort of moved away or apart. And I never lived with my family, thus my more extended family, except that I had a schizophrenic elder brother, half-brother. So he lived with me all through my childhood and was a wonderful, tender presence. But he was in the house, particularly after my mother went back to America. He was living with us. But there were lots of other people living in the house who were, you know, a lot of them, you know, staff, you know, servants, as they're called in Pakistan. And also all kinds of hangers-on. And there was a carpenter and there were all sorts of people. Because, you know, in Lahore particularly, where real estate is valuable, people, if you let them sit down for a minute, they may never get up again. And I think that was my father was a pretty laissez-faire person. And there were the far reaches of my father's house where there were all sorts of odd people living, which I don't think he'd ever knew that they were living there, that they just sort of stuck there like little limpets. Which, of course, was delightful for me as a child because there were all these wonderful, weird people around who I would pester them and play with them.
And also, it's delightful as a writer. I was thinking as I read your book, it's such fertile ground because there are literally many characters in every room. You know, when you walk in the room, there's many people there. Did you find that to be true?
I have so many stories. I could never run out of stories. I mean, for me, it's just a question of sort of, I keep a big file of, you know, little story ideas. And, you know, there must be 35, 40 pages of them. Because whenever I'm thinking of one, I just write it down and then on my phone or in the old days on a piece of paper and then put it onto the list. Yeah, you know, we in Pakistan live as a community, even within our houses, and even more on my farm, where, you know, all the people who work on the farm, we're they're not my employees. We all have a common enterprise. I've built a school there. They go to school at my school. Many of them live on the property. And we're all sort of commonly involved. Now I'm involved in their lives. When they get married, I go to their weddings. Yeah. When they die, I go to their funerals. When they need money, they come to me. So there's a level of attachment in Pakistan, which is really fruitful for a writer, I think. We're so connected, and living in the West, you'll know, you know, intimately about the lives of a few people, of your friends, whereas I am intimately connected, certainly at my farm, with hundreds of people and know a lot about them. And so as a writer, that's incredibly useful because I have all these wonderful quirky or not quirky characters upon whom I can draw and whom I know well.
That's really fascinating. So you've mentioned the farm a couple of times. It's your family's farm in Punjab, and you're still running it?
Yeah, I very much run it, which I know people think it's odd that I'm living in Oslo and running a farm. But I have people there that I've come to have a group of people running it who I trust, and I go there very often. I find that every few years I need to actually go and physically live there for extended periods. Mm. But I go there all the time. I was just there at Christmas. I'll go back, you know. I'm probably there for 2 or 3 months a year altogether, but I just sort of space it out. It actually works, strangely enough.
What do you farm? What are you growing or raising?
We're mostly doing mangoes. We have a mango orchard, but then also sugarcane and wheat and cotton.
So
it's mostly mangoes.
Do Pakistanis believe that their mangoes are the best? I feel like
not only do we believe it, we know it. You know, there's a big debate we have with the Indians. I believe that the best mangoes in Pakistan are grown in South Punjab. And the best mangoes in South Punjab are grown on my farm. And if you believe differently, please bring your mangoes and we'll have a mango off.
Oh my goodness, I love that. It's every Filipinos think theirs are the best. Egyptians think theirs are the best. Yeah. Okay, but they're wrong, yeah. Thank you for clearing that up. Is farming and writing a good combination? Are you able to write when you're there?
Absolutely. That's where I write best. I think if you are farming the way you farm in the West, where, you know, you're driving a tractor, it may not be. But I'm a administrator. You know, my job is to get other people to do their jobs right, and to oversee. And I'm a manager, and for that it works perfectly. It works really well. You know, when I'm at my farm, I'll, you know, get up. You know, writers only need 4 clear hours a day, 4 or 5, or at least most writers that I know, because it's just not possible to work at that level of intensity for longer than that. So when I'm at the farm, you know, I write in the mornings, I do my morning writing, and then I've got the rest of the day free to, you know, take care of business.
Was that a particular inspiration for This Is Where the Serpent Lives?
Absolutely. This is a book about power and money and business, and, you know, power and money and business is what we do as farmers, especially in Pakistan, where, you know, it's very... it's feudal, and, you know, we have to protect our business, and, you know, it's much more complex than simply raising crops. Right. So yeah, that's very fruitful.
Yeah, pardon the pun.
Yeah, excuse me.
I've seen your work compared to the Russians. I'm sure you have seen this too, Chekhov, Tolstoy, etc. There's a real denseness to your sentences and your paragraphs that I really enjoyed, and it almost kind of took me back in time to those writers. It just made me wonder about your process. Do you spend a lot of time revising, sort of piling on the layers of that density, or is that kind of how things come out when you are first drafting something?
By the time my first draft is done, I'm about 80% there. But, you know, the difference between 80% and 100% is many, many, many hours of hard work. Mm-hmm. So I get it done and it's all there, and then I start work. And I think it's in the revision, which may not entail, you know, it's a changing one word here and one word there and moving this and moving that. It's small, many, 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 many small changes. I think that's what leads to, for me, the best product.
Yes, and just careful changes. They're not just any willy-nilly small changes, yeah.
I love what Oscar Wilde said, which is, you know, I spent the morning, I spent the morning and I put in one paragraph, put in a comma, and I spent the afternoon writing and I took the comma out. And I think there's some truth to that, that when you get to the end of the process, just these tiny little minuscule micro changes may have a huge difference in how good it is.
Yes, yes. You had a full career as an attorney before you began writing in earnest, or at least before you began publishing in earnest. Can you describe how you decided to leave that career for writing?
Yeah, it was pretty easy. I was working in New York and working, you know, 100-hour weeks. And there was just this moment, it wasn't a moment, it was gradually developing. But over a period of months where I just thought, you know, damn it, I'd rather be a second-rate writer than a first-rate lawyer. And I'm willing to take the risk and just quit. And, you know, I think there was some surprise when I did. It was really that I just realized that wasn't, I'm glad I did it. Being a lawyer has made me a much better writer, I think. But it wasn't what I wanted to spend my life doing, you know, sort of putting together deals for billionaires was not.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it was great for a while and I'm glad I did it, but I'm glad I quit.
Tell me more about how it made you a better writer.
Okay. Well, the thing is that, you know, I was in this big New York law firm and, you know, a comma could be the difference between a winning or losing. I'm exaggerating, but, you know, very slight changes in the wording of a document could have huge impacts, could, you know, multi-million dollar impacts. So we were really, really, really careful with how we wrote things. You have to be because there's so much money at stake. And that really teaches you a lot, that each word matters. I had this wonderful, the senior partner at the time was a guy named Louis Begley, who's also a writer, actually, at the law firm. And I was working with him quite a lot. And he was known to be the craftiest lawyer in the firm. And every other senior partner, when they wrote the deal document, you know, the first draft, it would be, you know, 20 pages or 30 pages, the document. And Louis' documents were always about 10 pages. And we just couldn't figure them out. We'd have to sit there for hours and hours and figure out, you know, you push this button and then that rises and then this happens and then that happens. At the end of it, our client wins. There was a complexity to the documents he wrote, which was fascinating to watch. And, you know, sitting close next to somebody who can do that and watching it over many, many months and, you know, working closely with those documents gives you a real respect for an understanding of the incredible value of each word and the weight of each word.
Huh. I wonder if you would be a different kind of fiction writer if you hadn't been a lawyer first.
Undoubtedly.
Really? Undoubtedly. Wow.
And particularly in the case of this book, which is all about power and money.
Yeah.
You know, the lot of what I learned in working in the law direct is in this book, you know, about how the world works. You know, lawyers are worldly people. They have to be because they're, you know, operating in a very intense arena of combat in the world. I wouldn't have known many of the things that I've put into this book if I had been a lawyer, although I was a lawyer in New York, not in Pakistan.
But it's human. That is so interesting. I'm going to think about that for a while after we get off this call. And I'm afraid we're running out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to say about the book that we haven't covered?
Not really. I'm pretty glad with what we've covered. Okay. Yeah, just buy it. Get out there and buy it, damn it.
Okay. Daniel Mouinadine, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Daniel Mouinadine, author of This Is Where the Serpent Lives. Buy the book from Macintosh Books through bookshop.org or order it from Books and Books in Miami. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. We had production help today from Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.